Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. For New Year's, our show is a potpourri of interesting items. Potpourri sounds better than grab bag and much better than hodgepodge. In any case, I hope you'll stay tuned. Potpourri or hodgepodge, we're doing a bit of winter house cleaning on New World Notes, and the topics of our show will be connected more loosely than usual. At least, that was my original plan. We'll hear a neat film about the crimes of the banking system and what needs to be changed. We'll hear a nice essay by Paul Craig Roberts on the differences between Hugo Chavez and Barack Obama. A new song that really rocks by David Rovix, and who knows what else we'll have time for. Looking back over the hodgepodge, I see that maybe it does have a common theme after all, and that theme would be crime. Let me comment briefly on the big crime story here in Connecticut. In Newtown, a severely deranged young man with a severe case of autism murdered his own mother with a gun she lawfully owned, and then with the same gun murdered a class of young schoolchildren. This has resulted in mass hysteria nationwide, and especially here in Connecticut. The hysteria has been fanned by every politician in the country and by the corporate-controlled media. Now, there is a tremendous clamor for more laws banning this or that type of gun, or components of a gun. For instance, and especially, banning high-capacity box magazines, which the ban supporters always call clips, having little or no idea of what an ammunition clip is and how it differs from a magazine. The vast majority of distraught citizens, likewise, seem to have no idea of the difference between a cartridge and a bullet, or between a pistol and a revolver, or what semi-automatic means, or what gun laws are already on the books and strictly enforced. There is a well-established academic discipline named criminology, and another established discipline named law, and nobody seems to give a rat's patootie about what either discipline has to say about guns and gun laws and crime, though both disciplines consider these matters very extensively. People are screaming for new gun laws. Not surprisingly, every proposed new law anyone has mentioned lately has zero relevance to the Newtown massacre, including and especially a proposed ban on high-capacity, quote, clips, unquote. If you know anything about rifles, you know that it takes maybe 2 seconds to remove an empty box magazine from a rifle and insert a new full one. In the Newtown slayings, the capacity of the magazines used made no difference whatever. I don't care, people are saying. We've got to do something. It seems to me that great public upset, combined with great public ignorance of the subject matter, is a bad, bad combination, and a bad, bad basis for passing new laws. No good will come of this. As my father used to say in his Boston accent, mock my words, no good will come of this public upset. Same for passing even stricter laws on the sale and purchase of guns. Connecticut's existing gun control laws are already very strict. The gun banning lobby, which now calls itself the Violence Policy Center, says that Connecticut's gun control laws are the fourth strictest in the nation. No gun store sold a gun to the Newtown killer, Adam Lanza. No gun store in Connecticut ever would sell a gun to Adam Lanza. No individual sold Adam Lanza a gun or gave Adam Lanza a gun. No authority granted Adam Lanza a permit to carry a gun in public. Somehow, Adam Lanza managed to steal the gun and use it to murder the gun's lawful owner, who happened to be his own mother. So what additional law concerning gun sales has the slightest relevance to this bizarre crime? all the changes in laws regarding gun sales that are now being advocated from all the rooftops have zero relevance to the Newtown calamity. The only law that would have any relevance here would be one prohibiting parents of autistic children from owning a gun. This, the only conceivably relevant new law, nobody is proposing. And rightly not, I think. In sum, no good will come of this public anti-gun hysteria. As Dad would say, mock my words. But enough of crimes of violence. Let's take a look at good crime, white-collar crime, financial fraud and related felonies. The kind of crime that nobody goes to jail for. Except Bernard Madoff and Martha Stewart. There's a new organization of liberal to left-leaning economists that calls itself Econ4. Many of these economists are New Englanders. A good handful are professors, more or less in our neighborhood. They're based just up the road a spell, in Amherst at the University of Massachusetts. A great thing about Econ4 is that they're not just talking to fellow data crunchers. They're trying to communicate with people like us. They've got a few videos out with more to come. Here's one about Wall Street's mortgage fraud and housing bubble, and the bubble's collapse, which triggered the economic depression we are now in. But it's not just about mortgages. It starts there, then it looks wider, at the government financial policies that encourage Wall Street to run amok, at the repeal of laws regulating banking, and at the massive multi-trillion-dollar transfer of your tax dollars to the pockets of the very criminals who brought the economy down, with nothing gained in return. Remember, kids, crime does not pay. For the little guy. On the other hand, here is Econ 4 on the crimes of the banksters.
Nearly one-third or one-fourth of all homeowners in the U.S. are underwater on their mortgages.
The rate of mortgage defaults is rising, and we've learned from the government that 1 million home mortgages right now are in default or foreclosure.
9.9 million homes have been foreclosed upon since 2008. And as of 2011, there were about 14.3 million year-round vacant housing units in the U.S.
What we had was a whole financial system that were like drug pushers. They were loan pushers. And built up this whole pyramid scheme of bets and counterbets and shady investments and sold these all over the world. And these banks made billions and billions of dollars. Goldman Sachs, Citibank, Bank of America, Barclays, you name them. And then when they went bankrupt, the taxpayer ended up having to bail them out.
The policy of the administration has been to let the housing market adjust. That has involved millions of people losing their homes, enormous social suffering, and suffering that has hindered the economic recovery. Because people aren't able to get out of their homes, they're not able to sell their homes, they're not able to buy new homes closer to where they might get another job. I mean, and the whole economy is frozen up. The solution from the administration has been to encourage foreclosures.
Sean Hannity and other liars on Fox TV.
If they buy a house that they can't afford, who do you want to pay for the house that they decided to buy? They signed their name. Uh-huh. Who should pay for that house if they can't afford it, instead of evicting them?
These people who own subprime mortgages, most of them were not preyed upon victims. They actively sought those mortgages out.
Wall Street didn't stick a gun to your head and say, you know, go out and take the subprime mortgage and buy a $900,000 home when you don't even have $20,000 in the bank. Now the entire system is paying the price for that.
That's ridiculous. I used to work on Wall Street, and I have spent most of my career consulting to banks and major financial services firms. The job of a lender is to make sure that their loans have a reasonable possibility of being paid back. And if they made bad loans, shame on them. Many of the borrowers were affirmatively defrauded. There are numerous cases where the borrowers were told by the broker, oh, let me fill out your paperwork. And it was the broker who filled in the phony income figures. also saw steering, particularly of minorities, who could have afforded prime loans into more costly subprime loans.
They were charging folks of Hispanic or who were African American more money on their loans. Wells Fargo did not admit any wrongdoing, but they did pay the second largest fine of its kind.
It's the lender's fault that we got in this situation.
You know, in the old days, if you went to the bank for a mortgage, the bank had an incentive to look and see whether you could pay it back because it was going to be on their books. If you don't pay them back, they lose. What's happened with this increasing complexification of the financial system is that the responsibility and the incentive have gotten separated. They didn't care whether people could pay back or not because they were just going to sell it to somebody who's going to bundle it into somebody else who's going to sell it to somebody else. And the people who actually lent that money had no clue about the creditworthiness. And it was in the self-interest of unscrupulous mortgage brokers to go out then and just try to make a lot of money on volume. Make as many loans as they can because that's where they get their money. Who cares if it can be paid back because that responsibility is off somewhere else.
And normally in history, when lenders were that incompetent, they went bust and that was capitalism. And now instead we have a system where the lenders who are so grossly incompetent that they should have gone bankrupt are propped up. That's socialism for the rich, but somehow we don't call it that. To cover for the fact that we have socialism for the rich and the incompetent, we're instead blaming the borrowers to disguise that fact.
Trillions of dollars and free money being provided to our banks by the Federal Reserve.
As 9 of the nation's biggest banks reported losses of $82 billion while paying bonuses totaling $33 billion to employees.
That's where I think the government went very wrong. Because you have to keep the financial system afloat, but you do not have to keep the financiers afloat. You have to bail out banks, but you don't have to bail out the bankers. When the federal government came in and gave billions, and some say trillions of dollars, to underwrite the financial system, the government then should have exerted much more control over the financial system.
We created a condition where banks could borrow from the U.S. government at some of the lowest interest rates, and this is still going on today, by the way, at some of the lowest interest rates that have ever existed in history in order to increase the flow of credit back out to the economy. That didn't happen. They sat on a lot of it.
Until a hungry world paid its price. What a patriot.
Bernanke and his cohorts believe if you fix the banks, it will trickle down to the real economy, when that hasn't happened. Right now, the zero interest rate policies that we have are literally a $300 billion per annum transfer from savers to banks, from retirees to banks. And that's before we get to the lack of criminal prosecutions.
They didn't go after the bankers. This was a policy decision not to prosecute the bankers. They didn't because they didn't want to disrupt the vulnerable banking system. Yeah, the banking system was so fragile, they were afraid of scaring the bankers. Well, the banks aren't lending anyway. We might as well have thrown them all in jail.
And we're seeing the effects of that, of course, then translating across the economy as that economic insecurity continues to curtail consumer spending, which has led to a less than robust recovery from the initial collapse. And what's clear is the financial sector hasn't really suffered from this at all.
So what do you do about it? Well, the first thing is you just have to forgive a lot of debt, just like we have to do in Europe. You just have to bite the bullet. These loans are not going to get repaid, certainly not at face value.
Declare that everybody's mortgage gets written down by a certain percent. So if housing values have fallen by 20%, then let's reduce the value, existing value of everybody's mortgage debt by 20%.
We need to restrict the role of finance in the economy. It has hit the point where it is not socially productive, that it's more of a tax. They are driven by very short-term stock market incentives not to invest for the long term, and that's just destructive society-wide.
Limiting the kinds of financial instruments that can be put out there, putting higher capital requirements on a lot of the financial institutions, but restrict the size of the financial institutions and banks. Those are the sorts of things that can make a difference.
We had 30 years from World War II into the 70s without a financial crisis. That's very unusual in American history. The New Deal regulations were tight and they worked. And part of it is they were simple. They basically said banks can't do anything except these things. You know, savings and loans could write mortgages, Investment banks could do these things. Commercial banks could do those things. They kept it very simple. And that's what we need to go back to.
The financial sector is it's an intermediary sector in our economy. It's meant to support, you know, income creation and growth and employment. It's not meant to be, you know, an end unto itself.
The tail has started to wag the dog. It should be the productive part of the economy that makes things that people use is a real economy, and finance is the thing that kind of greases the wheels a little bit. What we've seen recently through the financial crisis and the rest is the tail wagging the dog.
You're listening to the New Year's show on New World Notes. The show is supposed to be a potpourri, or hodgepodge, of random items, but it kind of looks like we are focusing on crime, doesn't it? Speaking of crime, the handful of giant corporations that own the music industry, and the rest of the media, have been crying for years about the millions of dollars they claim they are losing from copyright infringement. A teenager copies an MP3 or records a song off the radio, and Sony BMG claims it has just lost $8,000 in license fees. And the poor, struggling musicians that the company tries to support will all go to bed hungry tonight, thanks to the piracy of Little Justin of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Well, singer-songwriter and recording artist David Rovix says that this is a boatload of hooey. Except for a few superstar artists, says Rovix, very few musicians ever get more than pocket change in royalty payments from their record company contracts. All those license fees and other sales the company gets get turned into corporate profits. Almost nothing trickles down to the musicians. Rovix supports himself mainly by income from live performances, and he gives away his recordings on the internet. That's not a business model Virgin Records would like to have catch on, but there you have it. I always liked Rovix, and I like this song, which is the main reason I'm playing it. But heck, it fits in pretty well with our look at crime today. Here is David Rovix advising, steal this MP3.
People are marching against the chiefs of industry who are trying to protect their intellectual property. Secret negotiations to make a secret deal. They've got Warner Brothers, Sony, and the presidential seal. They say they lobby on behalf of you and me. I say, steal this MP3. 50 years ago, what some call the golden age, indie FM was the king. The world was a stage. Independent labels made records by the score. Enter 2012, now there are only four. I've got words for these plutocrats who claim to represent me. In between commercials, they play nothing but the hits, and they hope to placate all of us with Lady Gaga's. They laid off all their staff before the PC was invented. Now they blame the world that their profits have been dented. The 1% is trying to get their feet. If it weren't so crude, they want to arrest you for sharing knowledge, for violating copyright. To quote my friend Attila, these capitalists are a blight. They don't care about the culture, they just want your money. The people don't want censorship by that name or another. They don't want your files searched by corporate Big Brother. And if it's up to most of us, no one would sign your bill just so hollow. Hollywood and Pharma to make another mill. So from the Mekong Delta to the Mediterranean Sea, steal this MP3. 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 From the Mekong Delta to the Mediterranean Sea.
David Rovics, with a thoughtful critique of the corporate-controlled entertainment industry. That's from his new album, Meanwhile in Afghanistan. To learn more about Rovics and his music, check out his website, davidrovics.com. That last name is R-O-V-I-C-S, davidrovics.com. A Connecticut lad, by the way, brought up in Wilton. Well, so far we've heard about street crime and about corporate crime, so let's not neglect crimes of our government. Our government has committed plenty of crime at home and more and bloodier crimes abroad. And let's tie this in with the sad news that Hugo Chavez's cancer has returned. As president, Chavez has helped make Venezuela a much more democratic nation. He has vastly increased the civil rights of the majority of Venezuelans, who are poor. Under Chavez's leadership, Venezuela has brought education and health care to millions more of its citizens. He has done this despite the intense opposition of the economic elite in Caracas and of the political elite in Washington, D.C. If Washington believed any of its public palaver about spreading democracy and increasing living standards, they would be hailing Chavez as a hero instead of damning him and working to overthrow him. American commentator Paul Craig Roberts is an old-fashioned conservative. Years back, he was an assistant secretary of the Treasury under Ronald Reagan, and he was an editor of the Wall Street Journal editorial page. Is that conservative enough for you? As any principled conservative would be, Roberts is appalled at the so-called conservatives in Congress today. There's nothing conservative about abolishing the Bill of Rights, giving the president the power to declare a war, turning the republic into an empire, and putting the government into the hands of giant for-profit transnational corporations. This is not any sort of conservatism that James Madison would recognize. This is fascism and imperialism. And of course, the Democrats are every bit as guilty as the Republicans. We progressives and principled conservatives like Roberts agree on a whole lot of things. The problem is that there's few of us and very few of them, and none of us seems to have any clout within the system. Paul Craig Roberts wrote this essay in October, shortly before the U.S. election and shortly after the Venezuelan elections, which returned Chavez to office. I have condensed it a bit for radio. It's called Don't Vote for Evil. Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez is one of the right-wing's favorite boogeymen. That's because Chavez helps the people instead of bleeding them for the rich, which is Washington's way. While Washington has driven all but the 1% into the ground, Chavez cut poverty in half, doubled university enrollment, and provided health care and old age pensions to millions of Venezuelans for the first time. Little wonder he was elected to a fourth term as president, despite the many millions of dollars Washington poured into the campaign of Chavez's opponent. Washington and the EU preach neoliberalism. Neoliberalism means the supremacy of capital over labor. While Washington preaches this, South America is electing and re-electing politicians who reject Washington's way. This has happened in Venezuela, in Ecuador, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Uruguay, and in Bolivia. It was the government of Ecuador, not Washington, that had the moral integrity to grant political asylum to WikiLeaks' Julian Assange. The leadership in South America is more and more rejecting the hegemony of Washington. In contrast, the U.S. political elite, both Republican and Democrat, are aligned with the rich against the American people. Paul Craig Roberts continues, "The Republican candidate, Mitt Romney, has promised to cut taxes on the rich, taxes which are already rock bottom. He has promised to block any regulation of the gangsters in the financial arena. He has promised to privatize Social Security and Medicare. Privatizing Social Security and Medicare means diverting the people's tax dollars to the profits of private corporations. Romney's policy is just one of many policies that sacrifice the people to the 1%. The Democrats in power may be a lesser evil, but they are still an evil. There is no reason to vote to re-elect a president who codified into law the Bush regime's destruction of the U.S. Constitution. A president who then went one step further and asserted the power to murder U.S. citizens without due process of law. A president who has done nothing to stop the exploitation of the American people by the 1%. When given the choice between two evils, you don't vote for the lesser evil. You boycott the election. Lesser or greater evil is evil. The only people who will benefit from the election of either Romney or Obama are those associated with the private oligarchies that rule America." That's by Paul Craig Roberts. Well, I'm afraid it's been another gloom and doom installment of New World Notes. Sorry about that. You'll find a free archive of our shows at our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUHFM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Illigit to my non-carborundum, Happy New Year, and peace.
It's the rich who line their pockets while the rest of us get screwed. It could all be a comedy if it weren't so crude. They want to arrest you for sharing knowledge, for violating copyright. To quote my friend Attila, these capitalists are a blight. They don't care about the culture, they just want your money.
Who steals his MP3?
The people don't want censorship by that name or another. They don't want your files searched by corporate Big Brother. And if it's up to most of us, no one would sign your bill.